nothing about this lagoon.
I can tell you something about this place. My boys call it the Black Lagoon, the paradise. Only they say nobody has ever come back to prove it. We'll do it.
Boom. In old school games, life is cheap. Don't bring your pole oil and rope and try not to go down in a heap.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Down in a Heap podcast. I'm your host Rob, podcasting to you live. Well, this time I mean it. It is live. It's future Rob. And one of the things I'd like to say, other than thanks to Colin Green, aka Spike Pit, for his rendition of my theme song at the top of the show, is that my voice in the following recording that I did with Jason over at Nerds RPG Variety Cast occasionally goes a little max headroom. It's not bad, really. It's just every once in a while you'll hear a little bit of a delay or something, and my connection wasn't all that great. But we got to together this past Sunday to discuss the last of the great Universal Monster icons, the creature from the Black Lagoon. So take a little break here from the Complete Adventurer deep dive to have one last collaboration with Jason. So hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
You mean this thing really works?
Oh, yes.
It's
very positive weapon, the spear gun, Lucas. And easy to use. All you do is aim it and squeeze.
What are you going to shoot at?
Make any difference?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Down in a Heap podcast. I'm your host, Rob, podcasting to you live from beautiful Northeast Minneapolis. And today we're taking on one last swing at the Universal Monster series with the last great monster movie series in their catalog, The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And once again, joining me is Jason Connerly, host of Nerds RPG Variety Cast. Thanks for joining me again, Jason.
Oh, happy to do it, Rob. Thanks for inviting me. This is, like you say, a long time coming, this episode. We've had quite a hiatus.
Yeah, I think we started back with Dracula. I don't know. Yeah. Was it 2021 or something? Maybe it was 2020.
It's been a while.
It's been a long time. We probably released one a year or something like that. But previously, If this is your first installment or the first time you've heard one of these, we did do Dracula, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, the Mummy, and the Wolfman, and the Invisible Man. So we've hit all the classic Universal monsters, with the exception of the Gill Man, and we'll fill that gap right now. So Creature from the Black Lagoon was a film released quite a bit after the heyday of the other Universal monster movies. It was made in 1953, is that correct? And then released in early 54?
I believe that's right, yeah.
And it was directed by Jack Arnold. From my understanding, it kind of developed with William Allen, who was the producer of the film, having being at a party hosted by Orson Welles, and he heard, I can't remember. Do you remember the cinematographer who was telling the story?
No, I don't have the name. The account I have pulled up in front of me just says one of the guests, a South American cinematographer, told the story of an amphibious humanoid creature who emerged from the Amazon once a year, grabbing a young woman from a local village and disappearing again. This was back in 1941 when he heard the story. So yeah, this is an old an old pitch.
Yeah, and then he just wrote a little treatment
and, you know, submit it or whatever. And then I think they kind of gave him the green light, and I think a screenplay was eventually written by Harry Essex, but it started out kind of a different theme, more along the blueprint of King Kong. And if you watch the movie, there's definitely a lot of elements that are shared between Creature and King Kong, the exploration, the discovery of the monster or whatever, the monster's fascination with a woman. The whole part of King Kong being brought back to the civilized world and him running amok. That's what happens in the sequel to Creature from the Black Lagoon. So it's, if you take the two films and bookend them, it's almost like a long version of King Kong with an aquatic creature that's not gargantuan. but it's, there's a lot more to it than that. I think the movie itself, there are a lot of parallels, but it stands on its own, and I think it's a really well done film.
Oh, I agree. It's, you know, it's interesting because this is the last, like you say, the classic Universal monsters. This comes out the same year as Them, you know, our famous giant ant movie. And, you know, we're switching into atomic horror, but this one is definitely not atomic horror. It's definitely stuck. But like you say, it's much more akin to King Kong than the other Universal monsters. This movie, you know, Gilman is treated quite differently from any of the other, main characters in those other Universal monster movies. They're much more personalized to a degree than Gilman is, I think. Don't get me wrong. We get kind of the personality, and you kind of get the feeling for Gilman, and we see him doing his own thing. But I think we end up spending more time with all the other monsters than we do with Gilman. He's treated much more. This is an interesting movie, the whole layout. And so I don't want to jump too far ahead, but even from the beginning, you know, this is set up pretty much even though we open with a Bible quote, it's a science movie, right?
Right.
Or pseudoscience. Right.
The Gilman is, I think, much more rooted in plausibility than in like supernatural, like a vampire or, or, you know, the Invisible Man or Wolf Man or something like that. But he's still monstrous, but this is one of the elements I think that made me connect with the movie more than some of the other Universal monsters, especially as a kid, is it seemed more believable, more plausible to me than, you know, a werewolf or Dracula or something like that, or the Mummy or something. So, and I think this, I don't know if you remember like the order in which you initially saw them, but I think I saw Creature from the Black Lagoon first. And that's also maybe one of the reasons why I like it so much. But
I think I saw Frankenstein first, honestly. Much more akin to Frankenstein, even though there are other ones I really enjoy. You know, if I had to rank them, we're probably these days, I don't know, it's still probably be like Frankenstein and the Wolfman and maybe even the Invisible Man, because there are elements in there that are just crazy. But, you know, on this, I'm really glad we did this, because the Creature from the Black Lagoon is the franchise I've seen the least of all, you know, all the Universal Monster franchises. This is one I had totally forgotten about the opening, with the creation of the world and all that. I've forgotten all about that. And rewatching this, this is a very good movie. It's very well put together. I think it stands up. It's so, just in case folks haven't seen this, it's on Internet Archive. So you can watch, in fact, all three of these movies are on Internet Archive. So you can watch this for free. You don't have to, although I've got the Blu-ray set that they did a few years ago. If you haven't seen this and you don't want to spend money, just go to Internet Archive and you can watch it for free, no ads or anything online. It's well worth your time. The sad thing is you can't watch it in 3D, which is the other great thing. Have you ever seen it in 3D?
I have not seen it in 3D, no.
Yeah, I haven't either, and I really want to. This was, I think, the first 3D underwater, the first underwater 3D movie that has ever been done. And the 3D, you can tell by watching it, even in 2D, that 3D is probably pretty effective.
Yeah.
There are some hinky things in the later movies, like Revenge, where they're using the ball to try to get him to learn commands, and they're pushing the ball at the camera and stuff underwater. But I bet this would be pretty good, because all those times where he just pops up or he's reaching forward, and I really want to see it in 3D sometime, but not at home with glasses. Every now and then they'll do 3D. Of course, we'd have to go to California probably to see it in 3D in the theater, right? But I would love to see it 3D in the theater. I bet, and by all counts I've heard, it stands up. The 3D is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like the 3D craze kind of went south in part because it seems like they didn't have very good projectionists that would show the film properly. So you get all these hiccups and it would be this blurry, hard to watch mess. But anyway, that's I guess more film history kind of stuff, but
right. I guess the only thing we should mention is the film that pushed them to do this in 3D was actually House of Wax.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because House of Wax had done really well. And so they said, well, we'll do this as well. And you know, supposedly it did. Well, this made a lot of money for them. I mean, it did really well. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So this has Richard Carlson playing kind of the lead as David. Julia Adams as his and the monster's love interest. She's kind of a researcher at the at the lab or whatever. And then Richard Denning is kind of he's the guy that runs the show basically, and he's also kind of the foil in the movie.
Right.
So those are kind of your three leads, and the creature itself is played by two different guys. One, Ben Chapman, was a really large man, and he did all the scenes of the monster above water or just like emerging from the water.
Mm-hmm.
And Rico Browning was a smaller guy, but he was a cave diver down in Florida and stuff, and he did all the underwater shots. And his swimming is really cool in this movie. I mean, the way he kind of like shifts back and forth, like on a lateral plane or something, it gives the creature a really kind of weird vibe when it's moving underwater. It looks natural or something, but it also is so much different from what the other scuba divers, how they're swimming. So it makes the creature, just obviously his appearance stands out, but the way he moves is different too. So it makes him seem more alien in that regard.
Yeah, he does a great job. Like, it's worth watching just to see some of these underwater scenes and him swimming. It's interesting because there were a couple inches in height difference. As you mentioned, Rico is smaller. So what they did is they added sections or removed sections from the chest and the neck to adjust for the height. Other than that, the suit was the same. There was no underwater breathing apparatus hooked to the suit or anything, where he just held his breath and swam underwater. The all the other actors, when you see underwater, those are all doubles. They're not the actual actors. Just real quick on Rico Browning. So he died last year, and he was the last of the people that had played as the Universal Monsters. He was the last, Universal Monster actor to pass last year. He also had a great career. He had went back to do to directing and stunt coordination for things like Thunderball, James Bond film, all kinds of stuff, and worked through the 80s, through the end of the 80s. So, you know.
And he basically got the break because he showed the advanced team the place in Florida where they were going to do the shoot. Mm-hmm. And they had him like swim in front of the camera just to see how a person would show up in the film in relationship to the fish and the background logs and seaweed and stuff like that. And they liked the way he swam, and he was a professional like cave diver who was skilled at just breathing off an air hose that was hooked up to a tank at the bottom of the the lagoon or whatever and stuff. And that's how he got his break. And they just asked him if he'd want to be the underwater monster. And he said, sure. And then, yeah, his whole career launched because he was basically like the chauffeur and just showing people around. So,
well, it just shows you never know when that opportunity is going to show up. And he does it's great. He actually played the underwater monster in all three movies.
Yeah.
We have. So the other actor I think we should mention real quickly, just because he's one of my favorite characters in the movie, if not my favorite, is Nestor is Captain Lucas. I love the captain of the ship. Now he has a short, it's basically a cameo in the Revenge of the Creature in the second movie. Yep. But he's great. I love this character, and I'd use him in an RPG any day.
Totally. He's totally the type of guy that you know, perfect like tramps, steamer captain kind of thing. So,
yep. He has fun. He enjoys himself. But as we'll see later on as we talk about the movie, he is the captain of his ship, and he's not going to take any crap.
Yep. So the movie itself opens with kind of an archaeological dig, a site in the headwaters of the Amazon or something. I don't know if they really say exactly where the camp is supposed to be, but somewhere along the Amazon. And they've discovered a fossilized claw just kind of sticking out of a rock formation that they've been digging into and stuff. And he's got a couple of the actor, what's his name? Antonio Moreno. I can't remember his character's name now in the movie.
I don't know. Yeah.
But he's the guy that's running the dig and kind of starts this whole thing off.
Oh, it's Dr. Carl Maia, M-I-A-I-A.
Yeah.
Or M-A-I-A.
Okay.
Sorry.
No worries. So he knows, I've got to go get help. I've got to make a more extensive excavation. Maybe he needs more funding and stuff too, but he apparently has some connections with this Oceanographic Institute or something. I don't know, this place that the other characters work, and he goes there. So he leaves the two, his two workmen behind, and goes off to get funding. And then while he's away, the two men are at night attacked. And this is a great kind of point of view monster kind of thing, where you don't see the monster, you just see something shambling towards the tent. And then the horror of the two men as they are subsequently assaulted by, and all you really see is the hand of the creature, which is exactly the same as the fossilized hand, except this thing is slippery, slimy, drippy, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you hear the creature's roars, and he obviously doesn't like light and stuff too. So
That's
all right. He quickly dispatches these two.
Right. It's interesting the roar they give the creature. So the creature never talks throughout these, but he's got his distinctive roar. And I don't know if you, I didn't research this, but I don't know if you researched into the decision to make the roar like it is, or what composed of it. I mean, there's not a foghorn in it, but it's an interesting, because it doesn't really sound like anything else particularly. It's not like they inserted a lion roar or something in there. It's
right,
kind of unique.
It's got a little bit of a gurgly quality. I heard that they initially were playing around with like a foghorn sound underwater or something, but I don't know what exactly they used to make it. But it is really distinctive and it's pretty cool. So
the other thing we're introduced here when we first see the claw come out of the water is the creature's, I guess the sound note, or I don't know what you want to say, the, you know, the, Yeah, because the blast. Yeah,
because
they play that every time you see the creature. Every time he pops in the screen, you get bombarded with that, which actually is pretty effective when you're watching it. It kind of, and there are a couple times it did make me jump a little bit because they do just all of a sudden blare the creature's, you know, his soundtrack when he appears on the screen.
Yeah, it's like a three note trumpet blast it's got kind of a fluttery quality to it. And not only when you see the creature, but even just signs of the creature. So if you see like watery footprints, it's bah, bah, bah. After a while, like if you've watched the movie as many times as I have, it's like, oh, here we go again. It gets a little grating, but yeah, especially the first time you see it or the first few times you see it, it's pretty effective. And the music itself in the movie, because there are so many underwater scenes, you know, with no dialogue and no real sound and stuff, the music score is pretty important in this movie. And it's really well done, I think.
It's Henry Mancini, so it's going to be.
Right. I think there were three different people that did music scores for it, but definitely Henry Mancini was one of them. So after the creature dispatches these two, then we go to the Oceanographic Institute, where he meets up with the other characters, Kay, who's played by Julie Adams, and her love interest, David, who's played by Richard Carlson. They find him out diving underwater and stuff and bring him up and tell him about what they found. And off they go to meet David and Kay's boss, Mark, who is played by Richard Denning. And both Richard Carlson and Richard Denning were in a lot of these 50s sci-fi monster movie kind of things. So they're definitely people that if you've watched any old 50s sci-fi movies, a lot of these characters, and like Whit Bissell too, shows up in a lot of movies and stuff. So,
oh yeah, definitely. And you know, they're action scientists in all sense of the word. When you think about it, both these guys are, you know, they'll dive, we'll see them later on. They don't send somebody else to do it for them. They're fully action scientists, which is kind of cool. We also learn that Kay and David are living in sin, that you know, they've been going out, but they're not, I make that sound like it's a bad thing, but they're, you know.
Well, in the 50s it was, I suppose. Yeah. So.
So I don't know if that was controversial at the time or not, but they were obviously a couple, but they, you know, they were waiting to get married. They weren't married yet, which.
Right.
Maybe plays a little bit into Mark's attitude. Although, as we see in the later films, the love triangle thing is much more pronounced, especially in the third film, where it's a really toxic version of it.
Right.
In this one, it's not nearly played up as much. I mean, with the creature, kind of is, but not with so much with Mark. You can feel there might have been, at one time, she might have gone out with him, but it's over, and we don't really see it pushed at all.
Right. Other than, you know, Mark seems to be a little bit jealous or resentful of the relationship that David and Kay have. So,
right, but he's not trying to reestablish his relationship with Kay in this,
right? Right.
Unlike in the other ones where you see that,
right,
yeah.
So
the other thing we learn here is when they think the period that this creature's from, this fossil's from. Do you remember?
Yeah, the Devonian Age.
That's right, the Devonian Age, which is a real thing, actually.
Yeah,
it's a real time. And when you look at the, you know, Joe would know that. Joe from Hindsightless, he's into ancient history and all, you know, civilization. Right. So he would know when the Devonian Age is.
But, right. Yeah. Right, but it just sounds cool. So
right.
So they go back to meet Mark and do their pitch and show him the claw. And right away, Mark sees dollar signs. He knows this is like their ticket to fame and fortune. If they can just somehow either bring back this creature or evidence of the creature. So he is all on board. In fact, I think they say they're going to start out the expedition like the next day or something, which is pretty ambitious. So,
right. And yeah. And the important thing is here, they don't know that there's a living creature at this point. They're just right. going back to get the skeleton. And yep. we also have an interesting discussion here on their ultimate motives here. Even though this isn't atomic horror, we are starting to see those themes as early as this movie, although other atomic horror movies are happening. This one isn't, but they do talk about this is really important because we need to crack this evolutionary nut because man has to leave Earth because man's destroying Earth. And so we need to figure out how man can adapt to go to the stars and adapt to other worlds.
Right, right. So they're looking for like this missing link. They show up like a lungfish in their aquarium and kind of those types of things. Yeah. So then we leave civilization behind and find the intrepid explorers, and you know they're intrepid explorers because now they're wearing pith helmets, right? You got to have a pith helmet, and if you're going off on safari or an expedition into the jungle or something. So they're on board the Rita, which is captained by Lucas, who is a character, definitely. And they have, along with them, they have the ever pipe smoking Whit Bissell, who's the kind of a meek, mild mannered assistant or another scientist or whatever, and Lucas's crew. So it's, I don't know, maybe 10 people aboard this ship or something, or this boat, I should say, but.
Yeah, something like that. We never get Lucas's last name. Lucas is his first name, I think, because he refers to him that way. You know, later on, they'll tell, because they call him Lucas, and later on, they'll tell stories. He goes, you know, Lucas knows that.
Lucas. I'm the first to enter the Forbidden Black Lagoon. Yeah.
He's great.
But right away, Mark is disenchanted with the accommodations. He doesn't like, he thinks the Rita is kind of this broken down tub, which, you know, it is kind of a tub or whatever. But but it seems like Kay and David are enchanted by the whole venture, and they seem much more interested appreciative of the whole atmosphere of the Amazon, whereas Mark, being played up as the murder hobo in the group, is basically just thinking we got to go get this the remains of this skeleton or whatever and find something that we can bring back and make some money off of and stuff and get famous for. So they get back to the campsite, and as they're approaching, Lucas is instructed to blow the whistle of the boat a few times to bring the boys out to let them know that they're on their way. And of course, no one meets them on shore, and they find the dead diggers or whatever, the workmen. And they're not really sure what did that, some kind of wild animal, but with huge claws and stuff. So, and while they're investigating the remains, Kay, of course, being a woman, can't deal with this horrific scene, so she's told to wait back. I don't know why she'd be leave her back vulnerable to some creature that's done this, right? But she's just waiting by the shore, and of course you hear the suspense trumpets, and the claw emerges from the water, and just before it's gonna reach out and touch her ankle or something, she's called by David and walks away, and the creature's hand disappears back under the water, frustrated.
Yep.
So they go into trying to dig out where they discovered the hand, and there's a long montage of digging, and as you mentioned, they're action scientists, so they're doing all the excavation work and stuff too, and sifting through all the debris trying to find evidence of the skeleton, and they come up with nothing. And it's not really, well, I don't remember if they say how long they've been digging, but it seems at least a few days or something, right?
Yeah, I think they do say, I forget what it is. Yeah, they do give a number of days. I forget what it is, but it might have been like 8 days. It was a few days. It was definitely plenty of time. They should have found something. Yeah.
Right. And considering that the hand was like intact, you'd think that the rest of the skeleton underneath would be somewhere to be found. Right, but
yeah.
But they come up with the theory that, well, maybe this bank like collapsed and into the water and washed away up the river to wherever why it would flow upstream to the tributary, I don't know. But Lucas knows that there's a mysterious lagoon that's supposed to be beautiful, but no one has ever returned from. So they set off for this, hoping to find that the skeleton or some kind of evidence has settled on the bottom of the water there or something. So,
mm-hmm.
So off they go to the Black Lagoon, and they get there. It's kind of a paradise. On the way, they're talking about how the fauna of the Amazon is so deadly, giant rats and 9-foot catfish that Lucas says are man eaters. Right. And yet they're pretty all pretty willing to just like dive overboard once they get there. And they've brought scuba gear and spear guns and Mark especially demonstrates that he's not afraid of anything that's going to be underwater because he pulls the trigger of a spear gun and he'll just deal with it with that.
Right. We also I think it was earlier before they got to the initial camp, but you have a scene where they're going down the river and Captain Lucas blows the air horn just to scare an alligator off a rock. That scene is reused in Revenge of the Creature. There are a couple scenes that are reused, but that one it just jumped out because I watched them back to back yesterday. It just jumped out to me. Oh, this is you like open the sequel opens up with reused footage. You're like, yeah, that's not a good sign.
Strictly B movie material there, right?
Yeah. The other thing that's important to note here, though, is when they get to the Black Lagoon, it's a very, very narrow entrance in the lagoon. They just barely can fit the Rita through the entrance of the lagoon.
Yep. And only because Lucas is the captain. That's the only way they got in.
Yeah.
So.
To be fair, he's a good captain. I mean, he is you have to give it to him.
He doesn't. I also like Lucas because he's definitely a lazy man. He likes to just watch other people work during the whole dig montage. Lucas is just kind of sitting back, chewing on a reed or something, watching him sweat.
Right. That's what I mean. He's a great character. I really enjoy him. He's one of the highlights of this for me.
Yeah. So they get to the lagoon and right away they want to get to it and go underwater and see what they can find. So Mark and David don the scuba gear and go down. So you've got a long, extensive underwater scene with them. Well, with their doubles in Florida doing the underwater work, right?
Right. But it's well done. I mean, all the underwater shots here are very good, especially when you consider this is, you know, the early 50s, you know, when we think of the later things, like we mentioned, like Thunderball, I obviously this is black and white, not color, but I think the underwater sequences here are at least as good, if not maybe better than what we see in like Thunderball. Cause that just seems slower to me than these Thunderball, the underwater scenes always seem to take forever, where this it's not as bad, but they're clear. They're well shot. It's really good footage, the underwater stuff.
It is. And so they're swimming around down there looking for evidence. And we have a few like shots of the creature. This is like the first time you see the creature's head and body and stuff like that, as he does a few like little jump scares that I'm sure are in 3D coming off the screen and stuff. And David digs up some kind of flowery seaweed or something from the bottom to bring up to Kay. And so they come up with news that they didn't really find anything, but that it's like another world down there. It's like nothing they've seen before and stuff. They bring up some rocks because the geologist wanted to establish the age of the, like, if it's the same age as the material that was, that they were excavating at the original site.
Right. To see if it did. Yeah. They want to establish that the original site, that bank, had washed into the lagoon.
Right.
Yeah. And they do verify.
Yeah, they do verify that. Yeah.
Right.
So they come up, and when David presents the flower to Kay and she's kind of helping him take off his gear and stuff, Mark gives some kind of cutting remark of, you can play house later, David. So kind of every scene with Mark, he does something to kind of like reinforce that he's the cad and the foil and the bad guy. But while they're down analyzing the rocks and stuff, Kay decides, despite the tales of 9-foot catfish, killer catfish, and seeing alligators and stuff, to take a little swim. And you get the famous scene of Julie Adams in her, for the time, fairly skimpy one-piece bathing suit. Mm-hmm. And she dives into the lagoon and starts swimming around and doing kind of mermaid antics, and the creature comes out. He's infatuated, or at least very curious about this visitor to the lagoon. Mm-hmm. And he kind of does this swim beneath her, in some ways kind of mirroring some of the things, some of the moves she's making. But this kind of interplay between the two is a really cool underwater scene. And when she finally kind of realizes that she's quite a ways from the boat, she's treading water, and the creature at the time comes closer and closer and reaches out a claw and just barely touches her foot. And you see her reaction, her feet kind of kick away from it. And then he touches her again and then swims away. And Kay then wants to see, what the hell is down there touching my foot? So she goes under and doesn't find anything because the creature has gone into some weeds and stuff. And then Lucas notices that she's quite a ways from the boat and tries to call her back. And in fact, they actually we'll come and get you, even though she's maybe 20 yards away or something. So they start steaming over, and she swims to the boat, and she climbs aboard, and they've had a net in the water, right? I'm not really sure if they played up putting that in the water before that swimming scene.
Yeah. Well, they talk about dropping the net in the water, and then they talk about putting the net in the water prior to them, because they wanted to catch some fish to see what kind of fish were in there. And right. Mark basically said, who cares about that? And then they dove to get the rocks.
Yeah. Okay.
So the net's in the water, and as she's climbing on board, something's caught in the net, because we start getting the tension from the net shaking the boat.
We should have brought a bigger boat kind of moment.
Jaws takes so much. Well, we'll talk about it after we talk about the movie. Yeah. Jaws takes so much from this movie.
Yep, it does.
So
you see all this tension on the net, the boat's rocking back and forth, the boom actually starts to break under the tension of this the thrashing that's going on in the net. And finally, as David is going to take an axe and cut the line, it goes slack and the net comes reeling up, and there's a huge gaping hole in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring it in and find a claw that's snagged in the net, and they do a close up of Kay, and it's dawning on her that she's starting to put the pieces together. Something touched me. I was in the water. This huge thing that tore through the net could have probably done something to me. And either I got really lucky, or this thing didn't want to kill me. So But this, of course, piques the interest of David and Mark. We got to find out, well, what the hell is down there, right? That's
right.
So they go back in the water with the spear guns and the big underwater rig camera to try and find evidence of whatever it is, and just film. And of course, Mark always wants to bag some kind of trophy. So he's out for blood pretty much all the time. So they go back down underwater and see glimpses of the Gilman, and he's kind of leading them around on a chase and stuff, but they finally get a chance to, or Mark finally gets an open shot and fires a spear into him, and it hits him, and he like swims away and then goes down into a deeper part of the lagoon, and they come back up with news of what they saw. And you know, it looks like maybe this is something that resembles what was the fossilized claw that that they found in the dig, the excavation site. And right, they go down to develop the film, and all they have was bubbles and seaweed and stuff. They don't catch a glimpse of him. He's like the like Bigfoot or something. So they right, can't catch him on film.
Now the spear that hits him is just, it kind of glances on his side. It's kind of in the fleshy, you know, it's kind of his love handle. So it's not, you know, it's not like it's a center hit.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so they're frustrated. They didn't get the picture, and David's angry at Mark for taking the shot, and he calls him out for being bloodthirsty.
Yep.
And, you know, Mark feels that, you know, even if they have just a body, that's good enough.
Yep.
But
yeah,
that night they get a visitor.
Right. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. And you know, it's interesting. I think it was smart putting Ben Chapman in the suit on land just because he is taller. Although I wonder, honestly, you could maybe put stilts on him or something. I don't know. I bet you Rico Brandon could have done just fine on there too. It's not like it needed great acting. You're in a full body suit, right? But
right,
but he is very imposing in the suit. You know, he was 6'5" or whatever. But the creature moves so that in this movie compared to the sequels, especially, he moves so slow on land.
Yep.
You know, he's just kind of really just one step at a time, but really slowly. But the creature gets on the boat, it kills a crew member. Or takes a crew member off the boat with him. And the crew members, I think it's his brother.
My brother.
His brother. Yeah. So far, only the South American hires have been killed. The helpers at the excavation and these two crew members. Well, this one crew member at this point. But so now
the creature has three notches in its belt.
Right. And they up their, you know, the next day they keep looking. At what point do they decide to start experimenting with the pesticide, with the water, with the chemical in the water? Is it around now?
Yeah, I think it's around now that Lucas says he's got this rotenone or something like that.
That's what they call it, I think. Yeah.
But it's something that makes the fish like they can't breathe or something. And it's a powder. It looks like a bag of baking soda or something. Mm-hmm. So they figure, oh, we'll spread this all over the lagoon, and it'll cause them to just float to the surface. So they go out in a rowboat with a bag of this crap and are dumping it over the side and stuff. And so this whole like
killing all the fish in the lagoon, you know.
Yeah, you kill all the fish in the lagoon, and the. You know, it's reinforcing this kind of ecological impact that this expedition is having. You know, they're scaring off the wildlife, you know, purposely tooting on the horn to mess with them and stuff. They're coming in, spreading all this crap that kills all the fish. And then they even show like Kay smoking a cigarette, and she flicks the cigarette in the water. And then you have an underwater shot of the creature watching this like, hey, this is my lagoon.
Right. Yeah.
So, but this isn't sufficient to bring the creature up, at least not initially. We see a lot of the little fish floating at the top and stuff. But they wait to see if anything happens, and they're keeping watch by night, and eventually the creature does surface. and he starts trying to climb a rope. And apparently to do this scene, they put a stepladder in the water for Ben Chapman to climb up on, because the suit, when it was wet, you know, started weighing, putting a lot of extra weight on him. No way, especially wearing the clawed gloves, he was going to be able to skimmy up a rope or something. So he's climbing up this stepladder underwater, and he comes up on the ship, there's a lantern hanging over the side, and he does the kind of like a Frankenstein, like fire bad kind of thing, mm-hmm. and sweeps thing away, and of course they see him and fire a couple shots off at him and stuff, and they watch this bubble trail as they bring a spotlight around to see where he's going, and they see this bubble trail go over to the shore, and he stands up and does a little spotlight dance,
mm-hmm.
And then goes underwater, and their conjecture is that maybe the rote known is affecting them, and they can go follow where he went. So right. Mark and David go over there and dive down in the area that the creature disappeared, and lo and behold, they come up in some kind of weird grotto that's somehow you access by diving deep, and then they come up, mm-hmm. again in a grotto that's above the water line and has a little beach entrance.
Yeah. So this grotto is a reused set. Do you know where it appeared before? I mean, obviously, no. Most things are reused sets, right?
Right. No.
It appeared in Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. This was like the throne room for the
really?
for the women on Mars, or the Venetian, whoever they met. No, in that movie, The Animal Venus, that's what it is. But it's like the throne room for the Venetian, the women that rule. Anyway, but it's reused from an Abbott Costello movie. Abbott and Costello did meet the creature, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it wasn't a full movie. It's a short. You can find it online. It was like a comedy short. But I mean, they used, mm-hmm. the creature the full creature setup costume. Yeah. But it's like a 9 minute short. It's not, mm-hmm. a full film, unfortunately. But
yeah.
It's impossible. What trial of us will do it.
They're in the grotto, and in the meantime, one of the other crewmen and Kay have come onto the shore where they were going to be, right? So so they emerge from the grotto to this exit that's outside, and the creature is staggered out, right? And is possibly affected by this rote known. He's staggering around. You see him kind of lurching around, and he's, even though they always show him being kind of a literal fish out of water, mm-hmm. he's not very graceful on land and stuff. He clearly looks like he's drunk or drugged or something, but he staggers out, and they're both watching the water, so they don't see him approaching, and he throttles the crewman and kills him, throws him down, and then he, mm-hmm. goes after Kay, and rather than throttling her, she just kind of doesn't really faint, but just goes to the ground, and he scoops her up like he's going to carry her off. But then the rote known finally, he succumbs to that and collapses. And just as David and Mark emerge from the grotto, and they come over, and I think David rushes to Kay's side, and Mark right away takes the rifle butt and clubs, mm-hmm. the creature, and looks like he's just going to keep clubbing him until he's dead. But David stops him, and they bring him on board into some kind of little holding tank that they've created, right. aboard the Rita. They have some kind of bamboo like cover or cage lattice work that they put over the top of it somehow thinking that's going to hold the creature that was broke the boom of their crane and tore out the net and stuff. And but he's under the effects of the Rotenone, so they maybe think he's weakened and stuff. But
yeah, they should have kept putting it in the water, because that night we have, so Kay is on board, Kay's frustrated. I think Mark, maybe there's another confrontation between Mark and David here. Pretty much every scene they're together, there's a confrontation. I think this one might have been where Mark wanted to go back immediately, and David's like, no, we need to investigate the grotto more and, you know, document some of this other stuff before we go back.
Mark is the opportunist, definitely, and David is the one that wants to make like a real scientific investigation into all these things and discover more about the creature's habitat and stuff before they just rush back.
Yeah. So that night, Kay's kind of on deck, and Edwin's, Dr. Edwin Thompson, Whit Bissell, is the one up there guarding the creature at this point. And so he's talking to Kay and kind of telling her, you know, you don't have to take that kind of crap from Mark. You've proven yourself as a scientific researcher on your own, and you don't owe Mark anything. Don't let him. He gave a really good pep talk to her. But the creature breaks out and attacks Dr. Thompson and is mauling him. And then Kay, you know, is able to get rid of it fight it off, because she throws a lantern in its face, which blows up very effectively.
Yep. Burning oil. That's what you always do when you face a monster, right?
This scene is super effective, because not only does she hit in the face, but she's off screen. So we don't see Kay throw the lantern. So what we see is the creature and the creature, when it attacks people, its claws are, you know, its hands are huge. So it can, you know, palm a basketball. It's got, you know, Shaq style hands. Yep. And so what it likes to do is put a claw on either side of somebody's head or something like that. And so it's mauling Thompson, and all of a sudden this lantern flies out of nowhere, hits it in the head, and emulates. I mean, just goes up in flame immediately. It's a pretty great scene.
It is. And the monster dives off the ship into the water, and poor Whit Bissell is clutching his head. And then they cut to a scene where they've got him basically dressed up like a mummy. He's under a sheet, but his whole head is bandaged up and stuff.
One thing of note here, though, is we do see it's not a gory movie by any means. None of these movies are gory, but you do, for a split second, right after the creature dies overboard, when they first get to Dr. Thompson and check him, you do see the scars on his face, and you do see a little bit of blood. Yep. So they actually do show wounds on his face prior to him being bandaged, which is interesting, because a lot of times, you know, they're starting to show that, where in the past, in the older movies, they would have never shown that.
Right. Yep. Definitely. It's always either off camera or obscured by a struggle or something like that, the wounds and all that. Yeah. So they've got a Whit Bissell trussed up like a mummy. They decide we need to do a bigger dose of Rotenone or whatever. So they tried it first in just the powder form, and that didn't work well enough. So then they like made it in little cakes that was more concentrated, that would go deeper. Maybe that's what brought them up.
Yeah, well, I don't
regardless
now, but
yeah,
but around this, well, no, but so this is the time. So we've had four natives killed, and now we have a white man attacks, and now it's time to leave. And this is where that sounds horrible, but I mean, it's kind of true. Because we get the speech from David about, you know, if he died, think of the loss, you know, not that the families of these other guys that died is a loss, right?
Right.
But this is where David and Mark are arguing, should we leave or Mark wants to stay, wants to get this creature. David wants to get out. And this is where David tells Captain Lucas, you know, we're leaving. And Mark says, no, you're not. And this is where Lucas puts a knife under Mark's you know, chin and says, you know, no, this I'm, you know, you, because Mark says, I'm the boss. And yeah. Lucas tells him, you may be the boss, but it, on the, you know, in the river, on the boat, I'm the captain's the boss.
Yep. Lucas makes his point, yeah, literally with the point.
Yeah. And they go to leave, but they can't because the opening is blocked now.
There's right.
A barricade, a branch, a big logs and branches and all blocking the opening to the lagoon. So they can't get out.
Yep. So the creature is, presumably the creature is the one that has made this snag, but maybe it developed naturally, but it, I always thought watching it that the creature was purposely did this.
Yeah. The movie definitely tells you that, or maybe it tells the assumption is the creature did it. And yep. the all of our scientists think the creature did it. And it was, there's no evidence he didn't do it. I don't think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as the Rita approaches this snag, they call out the danger and, but they still kind of glide into it. And this is a significant enough blockade to keep the Rita from getting out of this narrow opening. So they are now trapped with this creature, and they try and remove the snag with the crane, which the boom is now apparently fixed or replaced. But they hook up a winch or whatever to it and try and winch it out of the water. And it's quite heavy, but in the process of trying to remove it, you see the underwater shot of the creature, and he's tugging at the rope and actually undoes the hookup. Uh-huh. So he foils their attempts to remove the blockage. So they need to go down and try and deal with them and try and rig it up again.
Yeah, so I think this is. Yeah, so this is where they hook up the Rotenoon with one of the air bottles to be able to spray it.
I think that's after this confrontation. They try and make another attempt, and they go down with spear guns, and they fire off. Mark hits them with a spear gun. They have a confrontation on ship where they actually mm-hmm. come to blows, David and Mark.
Right.
And David goes down, leaving Mark kind of slumped over after taking one to the chin. And he's going down to try and just hook up the snare. And David comes down, or Mark comes down, I'm sorry, with the spear gun.
Mm-hmm.
And as David's trying to reattach the rope to pull out the blockage, you see the creature approaching, and a spear comes flying through as Mark is firing at it, and he does manage to hit it, but the creature pulls the spear out again. It's not anything that penetrates through his scaly hide, and there's a struggle between Mark and the creature, and in the course of the struggle, the creature, whether it's deliberate or inadvertently, kind of messes up his air tanks and hoses and stuff, and they continue struggling, and mm-hmm. Mark drowns, and you see him just kind of do a dead man's float to the surface, and Mark comes up, or David comes up, and I don't even know if they fish the body back in. Do they show him doing that?
Yeah, he comes up to the body, I think. Yeah. I don't know if they show it, but yeah, the presumption is they would have brought him back.
That's when they come up with the idea, I think, to try and, like, they don't have much of this Rotenoon left, but they have mm-hmm. enough that they
that's
can
right.
make a concentrated solution and put it into an air bottle that mm-hmm. he can directly, like, blast it into the creature's face.
Right, right. You're right, yeah.
So he does that, and the creature comes on board, though, again. And mm-hmm. this time, he abducts Kay and drags her underwater into his grotto. And, of course, Mark pursues with spear gun in hand. And and the rest of the crew, I think, must come on the dinghy on shore or something like that.
Which is interesting because we do, because one thing we skipped, not that it's a huge detail, but when they come across the blockage there at the entrance of the lagoon, initially, there's also a, or at some point in there, there's also a crash, and we see that the boat, the which I thought was their dinghy, their landing craft on the side, is broken to pieces.
Oh, huh.
Yeah, you see the wreckage of it. It's all busted up along the side. You know, it's down on the water line. It's on the water line, but that little, you know, rowboat or whatever it is, right. is all broken up. So they must have had, maybe they had two of them, and or maybe that was just an error.
An editing error,
continuity kind of error. Like, but they do show error. The boat broken up when they're stuck there trying to figure out how to get the blockage out. But yeah, the rest of the crew comes in and they all have Winchester rifles.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And David weaves his way through the grotto and discovers Kate, you know, limp body. Well, we see the creature carrying Kate through the grotto, and she's unconscious. And apparently, while doing this, Ben Chapman, while he's wearing the suit, especially for close-ups, they had different masks with different size eye holes, and he couldn't see very well. So he's trying to navigate through this fairly narrow passage, carrying Julie Adams kind of perpendicular to him, and apparently didn't notice that while he was carrying her, she banged her head against some of the set rocks and stuff like that and cut her head open. It wasn't severe, but you can see these still photographs of her being treated on the set, and everyone gathered around her in concern, and among them, the creature is looking down like, oh no, what did I do?
Yeah. It's a great shot. You can find, you can easily find this online, this picture. And it's a really great, cause there's a doctor putting this small bandage on her forehead. Yeah. The other actors are there, and the creature's knelt down in front of her. It's a great photograph.
Yeah. So David comes and finds her swooned on the banks of the grotto here, and then the creature emerges from the pool, and they have a set to and battle back and forth. David finally, I think, pulls his knife out and sticks it in him, and the creature, does he lurch away and then he fires his spear gun at him or something?
No, David. So the creature's, I think, by this point, knocked away the spear gun, or he's picked. No, the creature. So David's So the creature laid her out on what looks like a sacrificial altar, honestly, which makes sense for the Abbott and Costello goes to Mars. Yeah. So that's, it probably was in that. But anyway, it almost looks like it, which kind of makes you wonder about this grotto and the history here. Right. But
yeah, maybe the creature is actually a deep one.
Right. Exactly. I mean, maybe that was his intent to sacrifice. But regardless, she's laid out effectively, it looks like, on this rock altar. And he sets a spear gun down to go to it. And creature comes up, grabs and throws the spear gun down, bending it. Which, folks, if you go to YouTube and look for Gilman F this, you'll find there's a number of people posted. There's like this 43-second sequence of the Gilman just destroying stuff and knocking stuff around in rage. It's a great little clip you can find on YouTube. There's no audible curse words in it, but it's got curse words like the subtitles on it as the creature's just doing his rage dance. But the creature destroys the spear gun, and then it starts tussling with David, and they're wrestling. He pulls his knife out, he stabs it once, but what happens is the rest of the crew get there with Winchesters, and they start shooting. And the creature turns and starts going after them as they're peppering it with bullets.
Yep. And then before they can really finish him, David says, no, let him go. So the creature lurches away and this too, you can kind of can see that there's bullet holes.
Yes.
Leaking like a darker fluid or something as the creature lurches towards the water, and he dives in, and you see him basically just dive down into the deeper end and then go limp and sink to the bottom, or sink further down.
Right. And that, and then we get the end credits. I mean, that's the movie.
Yep, that's the movie.
It's interesting that he doesn't. I understand that goes kind of with David's character, but you would think at this point it would make sense to finish him off.
Yeah.
You know, when whoever the other, I think it was maybe one of the other scientists, maybe it was Dr. Carl, but you know, he's about to came up right behind him with a rifle, is about to shoot him in the back of the head before he goes in the thing. And David's like, no, let him go. Maybe you do need to kill him at this point, right?
It's killed what, 5 people and mangled another at this point. So,
right.
And maybe you know, will it survive all these gunshots and stuff? You might as well bring back the body, right? So,
well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, at this point, you got to do, I mean, that sounds more like Mark, but you have to do something to recover this disaster, right? But this opens it up for a sequel.
Yes.
Which they, I don't know. Do we want to talk about
this movie we can
more
just,
before we hit those, before we mention the sequels really quickly, or?
I guess the one thing I'll mention is that the creature does have is a sympathetic monster, kind of like how Frankenstein is sympathetic to some degree. You can kind of understand it being enraged by these people coming in and messing with its habitat. And of course, the first time it really sees anyone other than Julie Adams, they come down and immediately try and hurt it with the spear guns and stuff like that. So,
That's not necessarily true. In the beginning of the movie,
it killed the
diggers.
But they already invaded its territory. Well
but they weren't in the lagoon, though.
That's true.
Yeah. So I wonder if that was added later. Part to see him earlier in the movie, right? Because otherwise, we wouldn't have seen if the creature hadn't left the lagoon. Because the movie could have been made without the attack on those workers.
Yes.
But I think it is the movie's advantage. We do see the creature early, or at least its claw early, right?
I think, see the foreshadowing of the creature.
Yeah, I think that's important. But I think the fact to kill those workers who really weren't doing anything, kind of, you know, it's not totally a benign defending itself kind of thing.
True enough.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. Not to say it doesn't your point isn't valid. I mean, once they get to the lagoon, it's on regardless of what the creature's intentions were at that point. It's, you know, as far as it's concerned, it's definitely kill or be killed. Right.
But
I think the thing I would mention with this, and this would go with all of them, but especially this one, is the suit. So we've kind of talked about the suit a little bit and, you know, they adapted it, but what we haven't mentioned are like the mask and the way that they have it set up with the breathing, where you see the mouth move and the gills move.
And the gills flare out,
Yeah, it's a really well done. Now, the suit, although for years Bud Westmore took all the credit for it, we now know that a former Disney animator, Millicent Patrick, a lady, had actually, you know, she either fully designed it or was very, very much influential for designing the suit. She had a huge part in it.
Definitely the look of the creature. Her sketches are what they designed this creature around and stuff. So,
right. And we know that the story is now that Bud Westmore has kind of taken all the credit for that. I haven't read a ton about it. There's a lot of stories about him stealing her credit, but she should definitely get credit for the creature, the look of the creature, the design. No question about that.
Right.
But the suit's very well done in here. The suits aren't as good in the later movies, but in this one, it is, especially considering two different men of different sizes wore this and they added pieces between it. It's really seamless. If you didn't know better, you wouldn't know that A, different actors are wearing it, or B, the suit's been modified when the different actors are wearing it.
I thought they made different suits for the different actors. I thought each one had their own suit, but maybe I'm mistaken, because I thought they were filming these things.
I had read that they had added pieces to the suit, but maybe they made the cast. Maybe I misread, and what it is they had the suit mock-up, and they had to add the pieces to the second mock-up of the suit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe they are two totally separate suits.
Because they had very close fitting like body stockings where they even instructed the Ben Chapman and Rico Browning that they couldn't lose or gain weight because the suits were so closely tailored to their bodies that any kind of change would inhibit the way the suit looked and stuff.
Right.
But they definitely changed they definitely changed the suit in for the Revenge of the Creature. The head itself is more like just more oval or more round, I should say, rather than oval. Mm-hmm. And the eyes are more bulbous looking. It looks more comic than the suit for the first.
It's also a darker color. It's definitely not as good. And then
the color mock-ups they have of it, they have like and even like the movie poster and stuff. The lips of the creature are this garish red, like they just took some bright red lipstick and put on them and stuff. It makes them look pretty clownish.
Right. It does.
But
I'm looking at it now. It's pretty silly, which is a shame because this is great creature design. It looks great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, both on land and in water, it looks better in water.
Yeah.
Mainly because he just moves so slow on land.
I think Jack Arnold actually instructed Ben Chapman to be like a fish out of water. They wanted him to like glide his feet rather than take independent footsteps. And they actually put like 10-pound lead weights in the boots, the costume, to make him like to reinforce, hey, you're supposed to drag your feet and stuff and lurch around. But it does make the monster a little less threatening on land when he's lurching around like, you know, like the traditional kind of zombie with his arms out, you know, ready to throttle someone rather than moving really quickly. But all in all, it's a really good movie. I think it definitely is up there with the A-list Universal monster movies. It's among my favorites. It would be really hard for me to pick like a favorite Universal monster movie. Not, I think a lot of it just depends on what mood I'm in when I'm watching them. But it would be to me in the top with Frankenstein and The Mummy. I happen to like it more than like The Invisible Man and Dracula and The Wolfman and stuff. But those are all really good movies, and I love all of them dearly. The sequels, however, for Creature are much, aside from Bride of Frankenstein, kind of fall into that category of lower echelon movies. And Revenge of the Creature, the second movie, which was, they started making it almost immediately after they saw how successful the first movie was. This followed more like the King Kong script, where it picks up with another expedition, the Rita II. Captained by Lucas, they go off and they want to bring the creature back to kind of like a aqua or marine land kind of thing or something. Yeah.
It's Jaws 3D. Jaws 3D had, because this was also released in 3D. So, definitely a interesting movie. You know, it's been copied by others, but they go down. And actually, to the point where they bring it back to marine land, the expedition to get it's kind of interesting. This is not a must see. Really, the only one you need to see is the original Creature of the Black Lagoon. But Revenge of the Creature, I don't think is a total waste of your time. There's a lot of drama in there once they get back to the aqua world or the ocean world or whatever it is. And you've got this whole love story going on, side story and stuff. But it's not horrible. Although the ending is really abrupt.
And the characters aren't nearly as sympathetic because they're sitting here trying to like train the creature by using cattle prods and they chain him to the bottom of his exhibit and stuff. And it's pretty brutal the way they treat the creature. And of course he eventually goes on a rampage and breaks loose. And so it's also been spoofed on Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's a, like, I mean, I love that show, so that's a pretty hilarious take. That's a, the last time I saw Revenge of the Creature was actually the Mystery Science Theater version of it. So, and then in The Creature Walks Among Us, the third installment, as often happens with these things, they get kind of progressively more and more hokey and worse and stuff. And in this, it's some scheme to, again, like, figure out the biological link, and we've got a, like, kind of a mad scientist involved and stuff in this one. And
yeah, the idea is to figure out, and again, we tie back in to the original movie, the idea of having people evolve to be able to go into space and things like that. And so the actual hunting down of the creature in this, again, isn't too bad. The first part of this, once they capture the creature, it goes downhill. And the and the love triangle thing and this toxic relationship between the main scientist and his wife isn't great. But the when they're hunting the creature down, they're using sonar. And and it's interesting because it's almost like Aliens, and it's almost like one, you know, where you're trying to track by sonar, and here it comes, and they're, you know, it's right on top of you, and just that with the sonar. And it's actually not super exciting, but it's kind of exciting, and it's kind of well done. So it's interesting from that point of view. But effectively what happens is, the again, they hit it with fire, it burns up. The fire burns off its outer skin, then it has soft skin underneath, and they force it to use its lungs, and now it can't breathe underwater. And it's, so it ends with this tragic thing at the end where it, you know, it's, and going back to water, and, you know, it's going to end up drowning because it can't breathe underwater anymore. But it's a tragic end, but it's one you could definitely miss. It's not great.
Right.
The one thing we skipped with Revenge, though, we should mention, I think it's noteworthy, is Revenge is the first screen appearance of Clint Eastwood.
That's right. That's right. He has a little bit part, almost like a little comic relief part. But it's kind of fun to see Clint Eastwood in there.
Yeah, for just
very young Clint Eastwood.
That's right. Yeah. So, and it's at the beginning of the movie, so you can watch the beginning of the movie and see Clint Eastwood. So watch the first few minutes of it, and you'll see young Clint. I'm sure there's a clip of just his part on YouTube. But so the creature's given us a really, it's not as much cultural impact maybe as some of the other monsters, but the interesting thing about the creature is it is Universal's monster, right? You don't have like a Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Mummy, Invisible Man, and Wolfman. Like Hammer could remake those movies, and other studios now, you know, next year there's another Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein coming out with Christian Bale as the monster, right? But with the creature, you can't. Now we've seen the creature reappear most famously, probably in two places, Monster Squad, most famously for us. And then for other people, the Abe Sapien character in the Hellboy movies, which leads to Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water,
right?
Is, you know, really he admitted it's you know, like his homage to the Creature of Black Lagoon, and that's his you know, love story to that movie. It literally his love story to that movie. But I think of the Gill Man in the Monster Squad when I think of, you know, other movie adaptations. But that's kind of about it, really. I mean, there are little things here and there, but really there are no other movies.
And there were a lot of aborted attempts to remake it with Universal and stuff too. And they just never did it. Like they famously scrubbed one thing to make Jaws 3D instead, with the money that, you know, allocated for it. So, yeah, but I mean, it definitely has had impact, as we alluded to. There are a lot of things that come up in Jaws that are, you know, definitely inspired, I think, from Creature from the Black Lagoon. The creature himself has become an iconic kind of image and stuff. And because it is the intellectual property of Universal, I think they have a lot more, obviously have a lot more control on what things are, merchandise and stuff that are released for the creature and all that. So, I mean, I have quite a few different little, like, Creature from the Black Lagoon feet, you know, like rubber feet and stuff to wear for a costume and a mask. And I've got a little action figure somewhere around here, but also got a coaster, Go Gilman.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's a great movie. If you haven't seen it, I'd highly recommend watching it. Again, it belongs in the A-list of Universal Monster movies, and kind of relaunched the whole concept. Sorry, my battery's going out on me. I got to plug in.
Uh-oh. No worries.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can still hear you.
Okay. So, yeah, anything else to add about Creature from the Black Lagoon? It could certainly be a pretty interesting like germ for, you know, to get to our like gaming illusions and stuff. It could be like the idea for some kind of expedition and stuff, and turn into a whole Cthulhu-esque kind of thing or something too. So,
I think that,
and it's full of characters that you could pull out to use as templates for NPCs and stuff like that. So,
yeah, definitely. There's a lot you could pull out of here for your games, no doubt. I mean, obviously, these days, thanks to everybody's obsession with tentacles and Cthulhu, he's effectively rewritten as a just a deep one, which would fit perfectly fine. Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting because this was their last gasp. This did pretty well, but he was the last big creature, and really the only other Universal Monster movie made after this came out, other than the sequels, were Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, which we can argue how much of a Universal Monster movie that is,
right.
But yeah, it's, and the other thing I don't know if we emphasize, you know, this came out like say 54, this was 10 years after, well, House of Dracula is 45, but this is really 10 years after the original series stopped. Now they did replay them during the 50s. You know, it's not like today. Back then, movies would get re-released often every couple of years, the popular movies. So they were shown again and again in the cinema. So it's not like the original Universal Monsters hadn't been seen for 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm. But
still, it's like a last gasp by Universal.
Yep. And they, in their attempts to relaunch with the Dark Universe and stuff, so far, not so hot.
Yeah, but, no, and we'll see what happens. But I'm glad we talked about this. I'm really glad I rewatched it. It definitely stands up. I definitely think people should check it out. Like I say, you can just go to Internet Archive and watch it free online. So there's no reason not to check it out. I hesitate to rank these just because nostalgia plays such a huge part. It, you know, if we talk about, you know, what's technically the best movie, then you get into, I mean, obviously this holds an edge just because it was made 10 years later, the film technologies advanced. I mean, the underwater and the 3D obviously give this a big edge in creature design. But like I say, The Mummy's a great movie. You know, when you watch that, there's some, really amazing things in there. And so hopefully we're going to keep going. We've, even with the anchor apocalypse having come upon us, the intent is to hopefully still continue the series. We have a few more things we wanted to do with the series. We wanted to talk about the team up films like House of Dracula, House of Frankenstein, those. And we wanted to maybe cover the Abbott and Costello films.
Yeah.
And then also possibly the adjacent non-universal monsters like King Kong. I think at least King Kong is worth covering.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, and,
you know, one last thing I've just thought of is that unlike some of the other films, there wasn't really an actor that seemed to have like, that was like a huge star that was in this. There was no Boris Karloff. There was no Bela Lugosi or Claude Rains or even Lon Chaney Jr. You know, the creature itself was much more masked than any of the other Universal Monster monsters. So the actor behind the creature was virtually unknown and uncredited too. I don't think either Rico Browning or Ben Chapman actually got credits in the film. So,
yeah, I'm not sure. But you're right. This is that all the other movies, at least the initial movie, made a big point of, at least after they came out.
Yeah.
They made a big point, you know, because originally Karloff wasn't, you know, they tried to hide who was playing the monster, right?
Yeah. But then afterwards, he was a huge star because of it. Yeah.
Right. Where in this case, that wasn't the case because Rico Browning it or Ben Chapman or both, you know, should have gotten a lot more credit. And yeah, they're definitely not on the movie poster. I don't know. I'd have to read up and see, but you're right. That is another huge difference between this movie and the other movies is they didn't use it as a vehicle really for any of the actors.
Right. Even Julie Adams, who, I mean, is stunning. And I think other than the creature itself, I think what people remember, at least, at least men remember, is Julie Adams in the white bathing suit and stuff. So, but I don't know. I mean, she had a long acting career after this, but
She was Andy Griffith's. She was Andy Griffith's girlfriend, or not Andy Griffith's, but you know Andy Taylor, the sheriff. But in the Andy Griffith show, she was the sheriff's girlfriend. Yeah. And she did a whole lot else too, but
So, but I think this might be what she's most well known for by general audiences and stuff. So,
which is crazy because she did act through her last acting credit was 2008. And she acted in every decade. So she had a long, long acting career. I mean, I'm looking at it now on the internet and she was in a ton of things, including movies that, you know, everybody's seen. Oh, she was in McHugh. I forgot about that. We'll have to do the John Wayne series. but anyway, it's kind of a shame that this is her best known thing because she had done so many things.
Yeah.
But she's great in this, actually. And this is, although they do fall into the trope of, well, we can't go in there because we have a woman with us. And they do play that up a little bit. She isn't as helpless as women are in some of the earlier movies. You know, she has some agency here and she's, you know, she's not totally helpless. So although
she actually has like an occupation and stuff that, you know, she's not just along for the ride, so to speak. She has kind of a role too. So,
well, it's kind of like, you know, when you think about this movie and you think about something like Jurassic Park, you know, you've kind of got, although obviously there's Laura Dern has more agency in Jurassic Park than she does here. Julie Adams does here, but it's kind of the same kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
The characters of the two, it's pretty similar, but like I say, now Laura Dern's character does have more agency in there, but she isn't quite the damsel distress that Julie Adams is here, but it's kind of that same relationship where she's you know, in a relationship, she's another scientist in a relationship with the main scientist and they go to investigate this and, you know, there's parallel.
There's even a parallel with the Lost World kind of thing. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me to round out the series, at least on, you know, our Down in a Heap and Nerds RPG Variety Cast is where you can hear the other installments in the Universal Monster series. So if you haven't listened to them and you enjoyed this, go check them out. And thanks again for all the contributions you've made to my show over the years, Jason. I would probably guess that you've had more calls than all my other callers combined, but I mean, not that I don't appreciate all of them, but you've also been a co-host along with like Evil Jeff helped me out in the BX deep dive and stuff too. So, I appreciate all your contributions to my show. You made it a lot better. So
I'm happy to do it. Thank you for letting me. I've really enjoyed everything we've done together and I look forward to hopefully doing some kind of collaboration in the future.
You know how to get a hold of me.
Right.
All right. So thanks again, everyone for listening. If you have any comments, send them my way. And at least for the next maybe month or so, I'll be doing some episodes so I can play your calls. Send them to bigbalboni@gmail.com. And until I talk to you again, don't go down any heap.